Podcasting is a complicated profession, which is why we're here to discuss Andor, currently airing on Disney+. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined for our ongoing coverage of this show by my good friends and co-hosts. Tony Sindelar is here. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Dan. I don't have a child that I brought into this world. How are you?
Well, that's a weird way to open the show.
That's my standard greeting. Thank you.
Yeah. Also joining me, it's Kat Benish. Hi, Kat.
Good morning or good afternoon. Good evening. Whenever you're watching this, for us, it's really morning. And I just wanted to say, I thought the show was Endor and there were surprisingly few Ewoks.
That's in the later half of the series.
Excellent.
Yeah, the back half.
Kind of like the Avengers, they change halfway through.
Yep.
We are here to discuss the first three episodes of Andor that dropped on Disney Plus this past week. We're going to do a quick recap of those and then discuss them. But we should disclaim up front, there are many asterisks next to this podcast, not least of all, it is early in the morning as we record this. So we are all probably not on our best Star Wars podcasting game, I guess you could say. Also, I have a two-month-old, which is definitely impacting my sleep schedule. Weirdly, Kat also has a two-month-old.
It's definitely impacting her.
I know. What have a weird coincidence.
Well, anyone have they ever been in the same room at the same time?
No, they haven't. One of which there is only one. There's only one.
Oh, okay.
Oh, God. Thank God for that.
we are holding him right now. And he's, so he might make an appearance in the background of the podcast. But also, even if it doesn't, that's explained if Dan and I are a little punchier than usual, because sleep is very much a luxury right now.
Also, the child may also have opinions about Andor, so...
So, he may or may not be on the podcast.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see what he thinks. All right. Well, let's do... I think we should do just maybe a quick recap of sort of the overall arc of this entire three-episode drop. Because I think we talk briefly, too, about why we think... Disney opted to drop three at once, a thing. They did two with Obi-Wan, the first two Obi-Wans, but they haven't really dropped three at the same time. And I think there are some storytelling reasons why they do it this way that makes sense. I know we didn't talk about this before the show. Shall I do a quick discussion of what happened? Then we can get into more specifics.
Unless you want us to each do one episode or something, do it, Dan.
That would require us remembering where the episodes break, which I think is a little tricky.
I don't know if this is like allowed. I don't know if Disney is going to come to my house. I did watch them one a night over three nights.
You're out.
Which I don't, I have to say, that may not have been the best way to do it, but I mean, that was what my schedule allowed. So
you mean you didn't watch them in 20-minute increments and break halfway through an episode, then sleep, then watch the second half of that episode?
I think there's a lot of ways that you can experience storytelling in today's modern age. And, if you had any dreams about Andor, I think those are canon.
I did, but we can't discuss those. Anyways, all right. So here's the 30,000 kilometer overview here.
Clicks, sorry.
30,000 click overview. We are introduced to Cassian Andor, who we first met in Rogue One. Cassian is looking for his sister on a planet controlled by a giant corporation. He gets into a scrap with a couple of the corporate security guards and kills them, and then realizes, everything is going bad. So a lot of the first three episodes is basically his attempts to find his way off the planet Ferrix, where he is living. Before the security officers catch up with him, he has basically burned a lot of bridges with his respective friends, including a scrapper named Bix, who is sort of, I think it's vaguely suggested maybe they had once had a romantic entanglement, perhaps, or it did not end well. They are, kind of at odds at times, but. She still helps him try to broker a deal to sell an expensive piece of equipment with her buyer and get him off world. We also have a very zealous young deputy inspector of these.
Who's excellent.
Corporate security folks who is really upset that his boss isn't taking the murder of these two guards more seriously. And while his boss is away, he decides to mount a full-fledged police action on the planet Ferrix, which ends up going very bad.
Yeah, he really should stick to the quiet quitting. Like, that was not.
In the sort of last episode, we meet the buyer, played by legendary actor Stellan Skarsgård, who is there not only to get the equipment that Cassian has, but also to recruit Cassian to some larger cause. And they sort of manage to get off world. We also get in flashbacks to a young Cassian, known as Cassa at the time, on a planet that has been devastated by a mining disaster. And a crashed ship, basically they try to scavenge it, and one of their number is killed. Cassa decides he still wants to investigate and goes in and is found by two other scrappers, Marva and Clem.
The amazing Fiona Shaw.
Who essentially kidnap him, thinking that he will be... Yeah, they're trying to
kidnap
save him.
There's a lot to talk about there.
Kidnap slash rescue him for being killed in retribution for a dead crew member.
I have a lot of there's a lot of unanswered questions from those flashbacks.
I think I think there's more to come.
We should talk about it.
Should we?
Yeah.
You want to end the show maybe now?
I don't know. As a podcast? Yeah. No. I think we do it as a thing on this. We're already recording. Yeah. Let's. Hi, Kat.
Keep going. Hi. How's it going, Tony?
So that's the super broad overview of this show. As we just talked about, they dropped the first three episodes at once, and it seems like maybe that was done to make this an arc that is sort of self-contained, because the episodes themselves are a little more... They're not super long, right? They're probably, 40 minutes?
I was surprised how short they were.
Yeah, they're about 40 minutes. That's with credits.
Yeah. You know? And so these first three seem to really comprise this story of Cassian, like where we find him, the inciting incident that is going to change his life, and sort of detailing this world on which he lives, which is arguably, I think, unlike a lot of the other worlds that we have seen.
Canari was Midrim. Well, I think taking a step backwards, right? What we know about the show, and we talked about, I think, right when we were wrapping up our last series, which was the Obi-Wan series, is there's going to be time jumps. Mm-hmm. In which case, I think what will be interesting is my hunch is the next episode we see will have had a time jump, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe not, but in which case, like what we will get over the next total of 12 episodes.
Right. In the first season. And there is a second season already greenlit for another 12.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So a series of maybe every three episodes is a sort of little vignette. The story keeps evolving. So it makes sense sort of to drop that first vignette. Or maybe I'm completely wrong. That's also occasionally true.
And we also know for the first time, I think, Tony, we were talking about this briefly online. This is the first time we get an actual date in a Star Wars show.
Oh, yeah.
They say 5 years BBY before Battle of Yavin. And I was like, ooh, did Wikipedia write this episode? Because I was like, I don't think I'd ever seen that, any kind of references to that in, I think, in canon, basically.
No. Usually tend to be like, they drop hints somewhere like, oh, well, it's been 8 years since blah, blah, blah happened or whatever. Yeah. But like...
But it's a hint. It's not a text on the screen.
Yes. Yeah. It's not. March 25th.
But they're going to be
5 BBY. March.
If they're going to time jumps, it makes sense to like actually...
Yeah.
And at this point also, because we're all being like, okay, it was 4 years before this, so... How many years are we
have
after Obi-Wan?
How much time did we spend trying to figure out, like, how old is Ahsoka when this is happening? Yes. Where's Obi-Wan? You know, and it's like, no, timestamp.
And one thing I like, there's someone's job in Star Wars and Disney who, like, does this, who maintains the Bible.
Hawkeye Keeper. That's literally
really?
The title.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I was going to say what was really interesting about that, too, and we'll talk about this from a filmmaking perspective as well. This show also uses like titles, on-screen titles, to identify planets, which is something that Rogue One did that pretty much no other Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember when that popped up in Rogue One. I was like, "What now? Do we do this? You tell us things.
We don't have to guess what planet this is,
because it wasn't Tatooine. We weren't on Tatooine, guys. So, like, what planet is this if not Tatooine?"
And you know, I think that one of the things that my biggest kind of impressions from this is, one of the things I think that's interesting about Andor is, especially just in general, but compared to our other Disney Plus Star Wars shows, zero interest in fan service or even showing us things that are familiar to us as Star Wars markers. Everything is clearly still Star Wars, right? It has that look to the architecture and the technology and the design of things, but no planets you've seen before, no designs of droids you've seen before, very little in terms of familiar aliens, absolutely no lightsabers, TIE fighters, stormtroopers, X-wings. So it's like, we're going to give you Star Wars, but nothing Star Wars you've seen before.
There's one Y-wing in the scrapyard.
Yeah. I think that is interesting.
Yeah, I read a lot of interviews with Tony Gilroy, who is the creator behind this, who is also the writer, I believe, on Rogue One, mm-hmm. and was also, I think, brought in for some reshoots on Rogue One, who is, I think this is one of the impacts of this, he is not a Star Wars fan in the same way that we get from, like, Jon Favreau, right? Like, he is somebody who is, like, his background is writing, like, thrillers, basically, right? Yeah. He did a bunch of the Bourne movies. He did Michael Clayton with George Clooney. Like, he writes sort of taut, like, very realistic thrillers. And in reading some interviews with him, a lot of the stuff he talked about them wanting to capture was real, like this sort of, you know, more an experience that's closer to what we experience, like, in terms of real rather than in terms of making something that's fantastical, right? Like, there's fantastical elements to it, but it also is very grounded.
What I think it shows up too in the, like, their I forget what it's called, but the gigantic green screen,
the volume
they do not, I believe you told me, Dan, they do not use,
and they
I
did
think
not shoot on the volume though.
Had even if you hadn't told me that, I think I would have known that just watching, because the sets are extraordinary. You can tell those are extras, not CGI. It feels, the level of effort they have put into the set and the people and the costumes. I love the costumes on Canary, especially just showing that, like, clearly old, whether they're ship or other mining costumes converted to something more reliable in the woods. Like, it's just, it feels different than, say, Obi-Wan or Boba Fett, just from how it looks. And I think the scenes are, because they're relying a lot more, it feels to me, actually, I think I mentioned when we were watching, it feels like more like this was actually shot in the 80s, where you were relying on big sets and big, and I, like, the volume is awesome. Like, we can do incredible things with it, don't get me wrong, but this does feel different to me. It feels much more like a 1980s cop drama.
I actually just wanted to add to that. To me, it felt like Rogue One, right? Yes, like, the palette, the feeling, the camera,
everything,
the camera
is yellows and beiges.
Yeah, yeah. The camera's really ground level. Everything is kind of close in, gritty. You know, it reminded me a lot of the way, and there's no surprise, right? The DNA is basically the same here. So that
there's, you know, the action is very kind of sparse, right? I mean, we have this big kind of set piece at the end, but even that is not this kind of over the top giant thing, and some of it is like it's you know, it's two guys with guns being chased by a dozen guys with guns, and you know, I think specifically there's a shot where the bad guy spaceship, the patrol ship, like, smashes into something because it's been sabotaged, and they, like, cut away to kind of hide the explosion.
Yeah, you're right.
It totally is not right. Like, the explosion is, like, scene is kind of, it's more this, like, we have the pilot's eye view as he's being crashed into the thing, and it's like, it has this personalness to the death, as opposed to every other explosion in Star Wars would be like a giant over the top explosion in the center of the screen, and this is like a thing that is, like, horrifying people. Kat, you mentioned Canary. I don't know if I love, but I respond to the design of Ferrix, the planet where Cassian spends a lot of time just kind of wandering around, because I guess he lives there. And it's such a, like, it's this industrial, it seems like, planet. I don't know if we actually know what they're doing, but
salvage,
it's,
looks like.
Scrapping, or salvage.
Yeah,
or
everything is just, it's so depressed, and it's not depressed in a fantastical way. I was reminded, Dan, you know, you talked a lot about that very popular Star Wars game that had some references to that in Obi-Wan, and I went and played that. I'm blanking on the name. I played that between our while you were, you know, raising a child. That was my contribution in the last
Fallen Order.
Yeah. And Fallen Order
with
the adorable droid. Yes. And
the droid. Oh, yeah, I remember the droid being adorable.
Yeah, and but it starts on a scrapper planet. Yeah. But it starts on a scrapper planet that's like, there's Star Destroyers crashed and you're jumping through wreckage, and it's like, it's fantastical. Whereas Ferrix is like, it feels like this is an industrial town that's like everyone there is kind of depressed and getting by, and everyone's sick of Cassian's, you know, deals and scams.
I
and
talk
it feels
a lot
like
about
Cassian
that,
owes everybody who knows his name money. And people are just run down.
The analog feels like a mining town, right?
Yes,
like
that was company town.
Right, a company town.
But even like the griminess of the mine, like there's that scene where they all come in to get their gloves and they're like coming out of the elevator and they've all got like the helmets on and they're all sooty and like dirty and everything. And it felt very much, I mean, Tony, and you both, I know, have watched some Justified, a show that takes place a large degree in a mining country, and it kind of reminded me of some of the mining scenes there.
It reminds me of Appalachia and the United States. And and it's not, I mean, there are still aliens in the background, but we don't, it's not like when Luke and Obi-Wan go into Mos Eisley and it's this like fantastical weird place with there's aliens and there's spaceships taking off. It's like, no, this is a place where people are working and everyone looks sad.
Well, and it makes this is why the listener know, I think I've said before, Rogue One is my favorite movie. And I think building on what you're saying, Tony, is what makes this so cool is it's very much, I think someone thought, well, how would this all actually work, right? Yeah. If you actually had an empire, what would it need? What would rely on? What would living on a planet actually like? All our conversation during the Boba Fett show, trying to understand how, what was it, Mos Eisley? What planet, what island, town were they on again?
Espa.
What's going on? How does this actually work? And we never really got an answer, but this is, you look at this and it makes sense, right? If you actually, just the idea, the fact that you would have an empire that's relying on corporate security and essentially mercenaries, like, if you actually want to operate, you would have to do some outsourcing. And I'm sure there's someone in the empire who's in charge of keeping down costs. And like, they would have monthly meetings about your crime rates and just just the little details about taking off your gloves, as you pointed out, Dan, and just all that. Oh, here's what I was thinking. The idea that you have to land outside the city, pay a fee and get on a shuttle and go into it and then pay more. Like, why would you include that except to show just the realism?
Because people are stuck there,
how
right?
You
can't
live.
Just leave, right? Because it's like, why don't people leave places that are bad? And it's like, because it's not easy, right?
It's not easy.
Right.
Like, there are parking and fee requirements and there's fees for everything to gouge you. And like, everyone's out to make a buck. And I love when the guy's like, oh, you don't want to say what you do? Like, is everyone working shady businesses? Because that's the only way to survive. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I really loved the world building.
And it's interesting because it's like, we show this kind of mundane villainy and oppression, and we don't have to use the symbol of the stormtrooper. Like, knocking fruit out of a fruit stand or something. It's like, no, it's just, it has been run down by bureaucracy and by probably they're not paying these people anything. And then we have these like middle managers, this giant corporation that appears to basically have like a contract to do whatever it is they're doing for some number of sectors, right? Such that it's like, we have to go to another planet to, you know, grab a guy.
What's weird about that too, I was just trying to add, like, they point out like they don't even really have a presence on that planet.
No,
like right,
but
like,
it is part of their thing, and they're like, but things are different there,
right? And they're not like actively, you know, to your point about like you don't have stormtroopers like knocking fruit out of stands. Like, they're not even actively there, right?
Yeah,
like it's just the fact of their attention or lack of their attention that has depressed this planet so much.
Yep.
Is like, it's not like they're there crushing people like in person. It's just the overall like corporate.
And I don't think them even being there. I think they're already being crushed already by the Empire.
Yeah,
and the security there is just like, yeah, they're not worth our time of, because this, one of the things, if we want to sort of like break this up, we actually talk about the security, that's where we are right now, is
they're
a security group, not a police, they're not an army, they're not a military, they're not a security group, and I think they're a security group, sorry.
They're not a police.
They're not,
they're not nominally like a municipally sponsored police, they're
a corporate
private
police.
Security.
They're private security, and they're not even a police, but they're definitely not military, and what they do is essentially pretending to be soldiers, and that's where I think goes wrong, and
which is, seems like probably a pretty intentional direct commentary, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's always... you know, someone said, like, is Andor the first Star Wars show that has something to say about the world? And it's like, that's a little unfair. But also, you know, I mean, a lot of Star Wars is fantastical journeys, or it's about things, you know, it's about the explorations of characters, or it's about these big epic stories, or it's about the nature of good and evil. And Andor certainly seems willing to, and Rogue One did as well, to wander more into, like, let me comment on, you know, things that are a little bit more grounded.
Yeah. Well, it's not just more grounded, but it's more current, right? Like, you might feel like Star Wars in 1977 had a point to say about stuff happening in 1977, but we never evolved past...
Wait a minute, can Rebels be the good guys?
And arguably, there's also, you know, a hot take. There was some stuff to say, even in the prequels, about democracy and about, like, sort of the corruption of power and all of that. It was not executed.
They weren't as front and center, right?
Right, and it wasn't as topical, I think, is the point. The stuff with the police is something that we are grappling here in the United States, at least with now.
I think the way they present the, what are they, Primor is the contract people, the contractors, and they, the security organization is very interesting. I mean, I was reminded a lot of The Wire. You know, you have the senior guy who's like, I'm off to give a presentation. Just make this go away. And then you have the junior deputy, Cyril Karn, I think his name is. And he is the, like, no, I need justice. And I will ignore what my direct orders to get justice. And then you have this, like, collection of mall cops that work for him who, I mean, I think it's, we see their faces. They're not faceless stormtroopers. They have these outfits that are, frankly, not very flattering, right? And they're, I think you said it, Kat, like, they're playing at soldier, right? And it's like,
that sergeant
they don't
is
know
so
what,
like,
they don't know what they're doing. Yeah.
The sergeant basically, and just to talk about the deputy inspector, the moment that I love is when, and I'm still trying to figure out why I love it so much and like what it says about the character, is when the deputy inspector reveals that he tailored his own uniform, right?
Yes.
That he's turning this role into something that it isn't. He's taking pride and don't begrudge him for taking pride in his role, but what that says about him,
I feel,
is
like
just
maybe he
so
couldn't get into the Empire. I'm really like,
he has
jealous.
That I am clinging to symbols of authority, that like I want to be part of something bigger. I want my job and my, you know, I want an authority that does not actually come with this thing. And, you know, I mean, there's when he's doing his investigation and he's walking to these rooms with people at computers and they're like,
you need
we
to
don't
prove over time. Such a good
we
line.
Don't care.
That's so good. So good. Of course, these guys would care about overtime. It was amazing. Yeah. It was so well done.
Yeah.
But then I love that the senior inspector, he's right. He's not just turning a blind eye. Like, he's absolutely right that these, the two, like, he describes the situation of what happened on the planet where Cassian killed the two people down to a T. Like, they were shaking it down. They probably pushed it too far. And
they were drinking on duty.
They're drinking
the
on duty and
they're in a brothel.
Let's cover this up. Like, all these things shouldn't exist. They do. So let's, like, two wrongs don't make a right. So, like, let's let this one go. And I kind of wonder if the overall arc of the story is, what does it mean to follow an ideal?
Yep.
And in this case, Cassie and I, Andor, I'm going to get to say Andor all the time, isn't really following an ideal. He's just trying to survive. He's just trying to make it. Versus here we have the zealot who ignores what's ahead of him and is being motivated by what he thinks should be right, which kind of might be the story of the Empire as well, of what should be right and what that means. And I'm curious to see if we'll see that theme later in the later shows.
It's interesting, Tony, I think that you brought up the comparison to The Wire, which I also thought of when he's talking about massaging the crime stats.
Yeah.
But that last
also
confrontation,
when he goes, I thought of that when they land and they're walking through the neighborhood and no one wants them there. And you have the thing where all the locals
all
are going
banging.
And they're banging on the metal thing. I think as equal parts, let everybody know what's coming and intimidate the people, right? And there's things where
they might as well be yelling 5-0, 5-0.
Yep. Yeah. Right. And people are shutting down their businesses and you know, in it seemed like as equal parts we have people closing up their businesses where they may be doing illegal activity, as well as people who just want nothing to do with whatever is about to happen. Yeah. Right?
And that last scene with the fight I could not place what it was making me think of. I saw somebody comparing it to Black Hawk Down. But to me, it's a scene in The Wire where they go to essentially the projects in the in like the first season or something. They're like, they're told basically, don't go in there. Don't go in there at night. Like, just don't leave them alone.
Don't stir things up. Yeah.
And they go in and it just turns into a
Because they
cluster.
Think. Yeah. And this is, you know, I don't, they pair Karn with, I don't know the name of the sergeant but the kind of older guy who has a very thick accent, which I thought was interesting in Star Wars, kind of Scottish-y accent, and he's just all bluster, and he's like in an outfit that does not fit.
We'll show these people.
And they send a dozen people to go get one guy, and, you know, and they're trashing Marva's apartment, and it's like, you guys, it's like, you shouldn't need a dozen people, but also you have no idea what you're doing, and you're commanding squads like you're a military, and like, we're taking heavy fire. And it's like, it's two guys with guns. You know, they don't know what they're doing. No one on the planet wants to see them there or respect them or anything, right?
Plus they get a bunch of their own guys killed, right?
Yeah.
That's not going to go great
because
for that guy.
Because they keep underestimating what's going on, right? They don't get recon. Yeah. They don't. And again, I go back to the comment. It's they're playing soldiers, but they're not soldiers.
And it has the equivalent also of that feeling of policing where it's like, you are not relationships with the neighborhood. You don't know this area. You don't know these people. You're just going
to crush
them.
We're doing it the Western District way. And then McNally says, but who do you talk to when things get bad? You know?
And they get scared too, because I forget the name of Bix's guy. But
Tim. I remember it because it's Tim. It's
Star Wars.
To make it a Star Wars name.
Some who call him Tim.
Tim.
It's like Pim's Cup. Tim's Cup. The fact that he gets shot and it goes into every, I think Black Hawk Down actually isn't the years since I've seen it again, of people going in over their head, they get scared, and then they react poorly, right?
And it's like, you guys have guns with stun settings.
Yeah.
Like,
also,
you have technology that doesn't exist in our world.
There is also a bit of dramatic irony there in that you shot the guy who tipped you off.
Yep.
Yeah. Right?
Yep.
And then, like, the fact they even hold Bix and chain her up, and just like, again, the intimidation, the enjoyment of the power. It was just for me, the most heartbreaking scene was the fact that Bix was chained and left chained 3 feet away from Tim shot dead.
Yes.
And just couldn't reach out and touch him and mourn the body.
I mean, it felt very akin to things we've seen in modern policing where, where someone who is probably not a threat is being, you know, handcuffed or thrown to the street while somebody else is bleeding out and not receiving medical
attention.
Because
they were looking like they were going the wrong way, or like, you look scared, you don't look like you're going home.
Right. I actually really enjoyed that. Not enjoyed, it's the wrong word, but like, I appreciated what they were doing there, because the scene where like the guy shoots him and he looks stricken, right? Like, it's clearly the cop who is in, like you said, scared in way over his head, who just and, you know, shoots him, like,
and
that
gets sent back to the ship because he was not supposed to
do
that.
He is not trained for that. He does not know what he's doing. He is reacting, you know, in a way that is not appropriate for the place he is. We also can't ignore, I think, because it's established very early in that first scene with Cassian getting shaken down, the racial elements as well. He's constantly described as a dark-skinned Canary male in several places. When he goes to get patted, you know, when he basically offers the bribe to the security guards in the first scene, he doesn't want to put his hand in his pocket, right? Like, some of that is a ploy, but it's also, you know, has echoes of, like, I'm not going to make any moves because I know how this goes, right? Like, if I make a move to even to like take the money out of my pocket and give it to you, that could be a provocation. You could shoot me. You know, there's a lot of that element of, you know, racial tension, even though that's not something that we've spent a lot of time exploring in Star Wars. But it definitely, between that and the fact that so many of the people on Ferrix are played by characters who are people of color, I think really underscores kind of, you know, that aspect of as well, without necessarily beating you over the head with it.
I think it's impressive that, you know, I mean, Star Wars has always had this wonderful kind of gritty visual style, but it's like, can we take some of that grittiness and like make it social as well, right? Like, how do we show these complicated lives? And, you know, it's there's always, we pass through lots of weird environments in Star Wars, and, you know, I think of the you know, in more recent things, there's the, like, the underworld on Coruscant, where it's all, you know, filthy and gross, but there's usually more of a kind of a, like, exoticized element to it, versus this feels like, oh, we have characters that live here, right? And this is just their life, and and they're doing what they're doing. And, you know, Cassian has his, I did not totally understand what his relationship with that guy who's his alibi, who's getting off work, and he's giving him the story. And then he is like, God, and feeds it back to him. I go back to the security people. It's, you know, we've had stormtroopers as our antagonists for so long now. And stormtroopers are frequently as depicted as kind of these incompetent, clearly a kind of a fascist symbol. And it's like, they could have just used that again, right? But it's like, can we figure out something that's like more, like a more personalized, more bumbling, more incompetent version of evil?
They're also faceless, right?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. They're faceless. And like, I think the TV shows we've had have tried to give us, especially with the Inquisitors, like, giving characters that are our heroes up against. But since we're talking about that first scene, I think maybe we shift to talking about Cassian Andor. I think if one thing that throughout this, and I'm glad we're talking about this, because this is a show that I've been thinking a lot since started watching it 3 days ago, is even though I loved Rogue One, when I saw the first episode and second episode, actually, I wasn't sure I liked it. And the reason I wasn't sure if I liked it is, like, I don't know if I like the character of Cassian. And I say that because he opens up, and we'll talk a lot of it, but he opens up, he's an unusual protagonist, right?
Yes.
He commits murder. Well, the first one's an accident, and then he kills in cold blood.
Then it's not.
Then it's definitely not.
Which mimics his introduction in Rogue One, where one of the first things he does is kill a dude in cold blood. Basically.
And it's sort of a question like, but why? And then to your point, Tony, he's a mooch. He borrows money from everyone, and everyone's basically ready to cut him off. And yet, what redeems him for me is in the last episode, even though he's doing that, Ferrix, what's his name?
Ferrix.
Comes around and says, no matter what, though, he's still one of ours, and we're going to protect him. And at that point, I'm like, okay. So I take my read of what to think of my protagonist from everyone else around him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to see that he's not the Han Solo that everyone loves. Like, he's a questionable character. Like, he owes everyone money, and he killed in cold blood. He's our protagonist.
And he's a challenging protagonist, I think, at least from the Star Wars point of view, where it's usually we have a downtrodden hero and they are doing the right thing, and it's society that's roughing them up, that's giving them one quarter portion for a day's work or whatever it is, you know. And he is kind of a scumbag. I mean, he's clearly extremely cynical. He is living this rough life where he's like sleeping in a trash ship and scrounging around. And it's also a little bit like, but there's people around him who seem to basically be working a day job and he's not. I mean, it's rough, but there is, you know, I think it does basically, I assume there is an arc where he's going to go from being this guy to being an important part of the rebellion, and that's part of what we're seeing. It is challenging as the main protagonist, right? I mean, even, you know, Han Solo, who we see shoot someone pretty early on in their first interaction, whether they shoot first or not, it depends on your version, what you want to, how you read the sacred text. But that's not a Luke Skywalker who has like a purity to him and a call to action.
So
they work. Perhaps it's a very different, darker kind of character than we would usually ever see in Star Wars.
Yes. So, I mean, I think what's interesting about Han Solo comparatively is, like, when we see him, there's a lot of people who complain that, you know, when you saw the movie Solo, it undermined the change of heart Han has in A New Hope when he comes back. But I actually think there's a better point there, which is Han was always that guy. Han was always the guy who was, like, never quite making ends meet. And he was always, because he probably had a good streak in him and he couldn't really push that down, despite the fact he killed Greedo in cold blood. I mean, it was kind of him or Han at that point. But I think that's the overriding story of Han Solo, is he's always been this guy who has sort of a soft streak underneath. Cassian, as we just discussed in Rogue One, I mean, the other question is, how far can you go when you're leading into Rogue One? And at the beginning of Rogue One, he's still that guy who's killing people. He is just maybe doing it in service of something else. I think in a little bit, there's an element of the James Bond sort of, you're a thug, and like, but you, like, you are a thug for a cause. Like, really, you are doing dirty work, but you're doing it for a larger purpose. And it's not until then that we see the arc of his story where he goes from being somebody who's like, I am here to do bad things in the name of a good cause, to somebody who's like, oh, there's actually heroism as embodied by Jin. But like, I think in here, we're just seeing the conversion of like, oh, he's got a particular set of skills, and now we're going to turn them to use for good things, but it's not particularly make him a good guy.
No. We've had three episodes. It's more than 2 hours of TV. It moves at a very leisurely pace, right? I will say, you know, the first episode ended and my partner was like, did anything happen? And it's like, well, stuff happens, but they move slowly, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there were some criticisms and both perhaps of the actual episodes and of the kind of in... preempting this even the episodes being available of like, is this going to be a 12 episode movie or is this actually a TV series? I would say this is a little bit in between. The episodes, you know, not a lot happens in them. They do kind of, these three certainly feel like a set and stuff flows into them, and you have this kind of, it ends with an action set piece and a call to like, okay, now you're going to go and your world's about to get a lot bigger that you could imagine in another TV show might have somehow been packaged into 1 hour or something like that. I'm wondering, but you know, it is, we don't really have any sense of what does Cassian Andor believe in or care about at the first three episodes here,
basically,
other than saying
finding
a lot.
His sister.
Yeah, there's a little bit about finding his sister. And I was even, I guess, let's talk a little bit about the we have these flashbacks.
Is
his sister
them.
In that, I was also...
I think it's the little girl.
The little girl
who gets left behind.
And keeps calling, let me just... Because I think some of the flashbacks are confusing. I think they're intended to be confusing in terms of you're not being given the whole picture. So they are on this place called Canary. It seems like he is living with people that are not using technology. Maybe they're indigenous people or people who've given up technology, but like a very outdoorsy... world, right? Like they're in the woods, and it's a big deal.
There are some questions
there, because
and
it's like all children,
kids, right? All kids, everyone, of some ages, right?
And they're all wearing clothes that look like, and all their tools look like they've basically been converted from.
Yeah.
I would have originally said a ship, but I think as we learned, there's a mining accident that they're.
So I was like, are they orphans from this? Has the mine? Because they later reference like, oh, Canary, there was a mining accident and it's all been written off. And I was like, has that happened yet? Or.
Yes, I think my reading is this is sort of me piecing it together after the fact. I think essentially here's the question. The Republic.
Yeah.
Because they reference the Republic a couple times. But the people who show up seem to be wearing separatist uniforms on that ship.
But I agree that there's a cut when they're going to the ship. So first of all, as everyone knows, there were no subtitles, and I just want to say from a storytelling perspective, I like that because it doesn't. They don't then have to like skirt around answering questions. They can keep it very much. We're going to tell you exactly what we want to tell you, which was a really cool storytelling element. But when they're going towards the down ship. There is a moment where Cassian looks out and you do see a giant open
strip mine, basically.
Strip mine, open pit. And there does look like there's been a giant landslide.
Yeah.
And then we get to the downed ship and we see what I originally thought were aliens, but you see people in separatist uniforms wearing some sort of masks that have all been turned a mustard yellow.
I couldn't tell too. It's like, are these aliens or extremely jaundiced humans,
we think,
right?
That's when Clem and Marva show up.
They're
say
wearing masks.
Mask that it's passed. It sounds like that was some sort of gas that may have been caused by the mining accident or something native to Canary, unclear. But
my sort of reading is like the Republic or whoever came to this planet strip mined it, possibly used the adults as labor, like or in some way it killed the adult population, either because they were, you know, used to in the mine, or some side effect, the landslide or whatever, or the strip mining where they fought back or something like that, and essentially leaving all these kids as orphans who were then forced to sort of scavenge and create their own
Seems like for an extended period of time, for years and years. I mean, there's the thing. I wasn't sure even if everyone would catch it, but like, so Cassa, or as young Cassian is called, is in the ship, right?
I noticed that. Yeah, the reflection.
And he's seeing his reflection, and he's kind of freaked out by that. And then I think it's showing us that he is trying to smash every reflective surface.
Yes, that's how I read it.
As Marva comes and finds him.
I read that too. I read that as he's angry at being robbed of his, like, essentially, that this is, he's, I read that as I have grown up I'm no longer the kid I was. My parents are still around, and I've grown up, and I hate that, and it makes me sad and angry. That's how I read that, whether or not that's accurate.
There's a question of that versus even, like, how much reflect, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It kind of is, how much are you trying to treat this as sort of these are indigenous people who are not really using technology? Like, they set them apart, right? The fact that they speak a language that is not basic, right? Like, yep, that they can't talk to Marven Clem. They don't speak our galactic, you know, common language. There's no subtitles, as we point out, which is a story choice to be like, this isn't like Greedo or Jabba where we get the subtitles even though they're speaking in an alien language. It's got an interesting angle to it to, you know, sort of say, well, these people are apart in some ways from the galactic community or not in contact with them. And how much are you trying to sort of draw a line to sort of indigenous peoples who maybe, you know, had their land taken and...
Well, and yeah, I was wondering, like, robbed. It seems like Cassian and his sister... I wasn't sure if it was a biological sister or just another kid that he's being raised with, right? Because there's a lot in here with kind of like family that is found family or whatnot. Yeah. But I was also like, are all of these people kids? Is it kids that have been adopted by an indigenous group? And, you know, I think the answer is we don't know. But it certainly might, I guess, because they have no technology and they're in a Star Wars world, I assume they've been there for quite a long time, right? Well, because everyone in Star Wars has a couple, you know, you've got a blaster or a flashlight or a, you know, a scanner or a comm thing or something, and they have, like, sticks.
They've got the blow darts. But the thing that gives me sense that they actually are, so when we first see the ship crashing, I think there's a little girl, a little boy who jumps out and starts waving as if wanting to be seen, which to me evoked, please rescue us.
Yeah.
Then they get pulled back. So there's definitely more there. I think the older kids are like, no, we need to be wary. Mm-hmm. But then I think the timing is weird too, right? So your point of the separatists, we know, I guess we have
Cassian, how old do you think Cassa is there?
He looks...
I was going to say not more than
8 to 12.
Yeah, I was going to say not more than 10 in my mind. Yeah. But yeah, kind of in that.
And so, guess. But then there's the separatist uniform they find. But then Marva says the Republic's coming and going to kill them, which was very unusual behavior. So trying to figure out when this was and the idea. Right. So one of the things about the Empire that is so evocative, right, of like why no one likes the Empire is because they usually are portrayed as being completely anti-environmental and just strip mining these planets, right? Yeah. We see that again and again. So to see that associated with the Republic makes me really question what part of the Republic was this?
Is this the downfall of the Republic? Is this perhaps the dark side of the Republic that we never saw? Like, I don't know. It is interesting. And part of me is just like,
I don't think they're going to tell us.
Is there a point here, or is there like maybe even, you know, some confusion on the storytellers' parts here? It's kind of hard to read, but I don't think we've seen at least the end of the flashbacks. We know in the present day, he considers Marva his mother. We have that mentioned several times.
We also think Clem might be his father.
Who's mentioned as being hung.
They don't say that, hanged, but they, you know, Clem is not around in the future. And in the longest section of dialogue in the three episodes, there's a reference to the Imperials hanging his father. So my connecting the dots there is Clem's not there in our present day.
Right. I do also want to, there are a couple other things we should talk about. I want to mention B, the droid.
I
love.
Instantly adorable.
What a great droid.
And I even like, there's the scene in episode 3 where they cut back and forth. They're doing a lot of cutting back and forth between the past timeline of the future. And there's a great cut where B is rolling across the junkyard or whatever.
Yes.
Just the street of Ferrix. And then a cart passes in front. And it's the, I didn't get it at first. It's B in, I don't know, mint condition 15, 20 years ago, rolling through the wreckage, rolling through the hallway of the, crashed ship, and it's, you know, shiny, seems to be mechanically much more intact, has all its treads are the same color, etc. But lovely as, and you know, there's a lot of adorable droids in Star Wars. It's always like, can we do more? I'm reminded of the Leia's adorable droid in Obi-Wan, I do really like that droid in the video game Fallen Empire. But this is a new, it's like, I think of it as a very analog droid where it like stutters and it has trouble accessing its memory. And, you know, we've seen the droids get kind of, you know, I guess we learned R2-D2 and C-3PO are clanging around for quite a while, but this is a droid that shows its mileage.
Right. You know? I enjoyed the design of it. It's very, it's evocative of droids that we know, but is also very instantly different from those droids. It has, I love it, sort of accordion style thing that provides emoting. I think the voice is great. It reminds me, I can't quite place what the voice reminds me of. There's like a robot in like Interstellar or something that kind of has a similar vibe to me.
There's weird conversations with it where he's like, I need you to lie. Do you have enough like charge to do that? I think there's some Muppet-like qualities to it.
This reminds me of just like the, again, living with basic technology of like, oh yeah, I do have to charge my phone 3 times a day. I know exactly how this feels. Do you have to go back to charge? Makes sense. Yeah, it's frustrating.
I enjoyed the scene as well where like he's sort of inexpertly like, you know, he's giving him a comm link or whatever, and he's trying to talk about him. And for some reason, as a podcaster, I'm like, wait, why is the stuff that he says to be audible on the headphone, like on the speakers? That's such bad design. But you know what? You do what you can. Like,
I'm willing to believe that. You know, the droids in Star Wars don't totally make any sense in terms of why would you make any droid that can't talk in our language, but like, why would you have a droid that doesn't have a comm unit like in its circuitry so you can talk directly to it versus it being broadcast in the room? But because, I don't know, because these things are very industrial and being perhaps used in ways they were
but
not.
But I enjoyed that, right? Because you have this moment where he's like, you're sitting there and everyone can hear, and B's like, well, I'm not going to respond because that would be dumb. And you're like, no, it doesn't really matter, but like, it's a game of you to try.
And even just this kind of weird thing where Cassian is sleeping in the ship, and we see at the very last shot, it's the ship that he was taken away from Canary in, and it's kind of a junker, right? It's falling apart.
It's not functional. Yeah,
it's not functional. It's basically like he's sleeping in a van in a trap in an auto wreckage yard
up on like, you know, concrete blocks or something.
Yeah, and the droid is basically wandering back and forth to chat with Cassian, and then going back to the apartment where Marva is, and even just that, like, Cassian has this conversation with the droid kind of about his family before we see any of them is kind of strange and weird, and it shows this like distance between Cassian it's like he's not, you know, it's like, why aren't you sleeping in your bunk or your bed at home? And it's like, well, you're up to some bad stuff, and maybe, you know, you'd have to answer some questions when you finally came
home. And he is,
but also they want
to
know where you are,
think,
right?
I think he does have, we see elements of what make him a good person, I think. Like, he's not always acting on those instincts, but like the fact that I think he is trying to distance himself from Marva in some ways to protect her is an element of that.
And always telling her to keep the heat on and getting others to get the heat on too.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And like,
definitely the last shot of her shows her breath. It's like, no, she doesn't have the heat on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, as you know, Kat, as you mentioned, all his relationships with everybody else would show that he's kind of burned all his bridges and is not really, like, you know, borrowed
too
much money.
Not a friend you want.
Nobody really wants to help him out. But yeah, there are still some people. I really enjoyed the characters we saw, both Bix. I thought she has a very complex relationship, right? Like, you know, she's running around helping Cassian, even though she's nominally in a relationship with Tim, and he's very, you know, jealous of this.
But their relationship does not seem super happy, you know?
No. It seems one of convenience more than of actual genuine. At least he seems to maybe have some genuine affection for her. She's kind of treats him like a convenience.
No, I mean, I think there's something there. I mean, the fact that she shows up late at night, like, looking for... It may not
a booty call.
Yes. But, like, she... I mean, she's still... There's still emotion in that, right?
Yes.
It's just, like, I think he... she has a lot of secrets, I think, is really the issue. Yeah. And yeah, Tim is the jealous type. But but I think she's interesting. Again, she is working with the Proto-Rebellion, may or may not know that.
Yeah.
Yep. But she's definitely skimming off the top. That's her shady business.
Right. She's she's not exactly a fence, but like she is definitely working a black market angle. Yes.
Out of someone else's shop.
Out of some, yeah. Well, was, who may or may not totally be involved understand. In that. Yeah.
No,
I was
she
a little confused
Tim
by
anything.
What the business oh, relationship yeah, yeah. there was. And so it seemed like they're clearly their coworkers or employer, employee, and also sleeping together. And that's maybe not okay, slash, or at least complicated. Is Tim the boss or the owner? I wasn't
I
sure
Tim,
who was.
Said, seemed, I thought it was said I, that Tim was the owner at the very start.
I thought
start.
So okay. too, but yeah. And then right. there's also the other shop that she goes
yes.
to when she needs to make
she
the call.
She climbs up the thing and sends
oh, yeah.
the signal.
Yeah,
yeah.
I
yeah.
Love
and they
that.
Show up later too. It's the
they
father
do.
And
the
son.
Yeah,
yeah. Who I thought was good. And then I wanted to did want to mention you mentioned I think before his pal Brasso.
Brasso.
yeah, I did think of Only Murders
this,
in the Building.
This sends the plot in a whole new direction.
Yeah, yeah.
Who I loved.
I like that guy a lot.
He was
I thought
great.
He has a great. So to your point, Tony, about like Cassian does not seem to be holding down a day job. I definitely had the feeling that at some point he worked in the scrapyard
yes,
and then decided he was too good for it. Essentially,
my headcanon is he got fired for drinking or not showing up or something.
Or insubordination.
Right?
Yeah, but I love the interaction where he comes in like. Cassian tries to tell the story, and Brasso's like, Brasso. It's like, yeah, sure, but I'm not going to make you look better in the story, right? You insulted my drink, I punched you.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the Cassian Andor character that has some kind of weird parallels for, like, substance abuse that, and he's sick of, and people are like, who had to, borrow money from him to pay for his drinking or things like that. And he's broken people's things. And, I don't think that that's in there. And maybe it's that he's spending the money looking for his sister. Right. But there are a lot of the kind of tropes are in there in terms of like, no one can rely on him. He is a nice guy, maybe, or they're loyal to him because he's from the neighborhood, or people hope things will work out better for him. But everybody has been like
burned by him.
What's interesting about that, though, is when he's leaving, though, he tells Brasso that like all the money he owes him is in the apartment, right? Like, and you're like, you kind of get the feeling that maybe some of this is him squirreling a lot of money away, but that he doesn't necessarily like.
Well, I don't think he's going to have the money. No. He only gets the money if he sells the box.
My implication was that he was using that to get off world, but that
my assumption was like the reason he gave the comlink to B is because he told B, I need to tell you how to get the money in case I can't get back.
Right. I just didn't know. It sounded like maybe he already had some squirreled away, but it's unclear.
It's unclear. Not fully relevant either.
And I do want to discuss, too, I think, his interactions with, Luthen, I believe.
We have not talked about him. Is his name said in the show?
It's not said, but it's in the subtitles.
Which one's Luthen?
Okay.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Oh, yeah.
Noted physics professor Stellan Skarsgård. Yes.
The character was like, who is that again? Dan's like,
the character
so
literally
like
an episode walking to town.
But the interesting part there is I love this. So Luthen knows who he is. He has basically been trying, talking to Bix about recruiting him for some reason we don't quite understand in terms of like how does he know he exists? How does he know exactly like, she's mentioned Cassian to him and the assumption is like he has some interest in recruiting him. Cassian has this whole thing where he's stolen this one unit, right?
MacGuffin.
We don't know what it is. MacGuffin, yeah. This suitcase, whatever. And he has this brilliant bit, which I really enjoyed, which is him talking about how you steal for the Empire, which is like...
Yes.
Yeah. This is my skill.
Like kind of the first, like, what is your deal? What do you believe about the world moment for Cassian? There is kind of this tension that builds up to this, like, basically longest conversation in the three episodes at the end of episode three, where, we get a little bit from Cassian and a little bit from Luthen, where it's like, what do these people actually believe about the world / what's going on? And I think this was released as, like, a clip ahead of time, and I can kind of see why.
Yeah.
Though I think maybe one benefits from getting it in context here, where it's like... Yes. The Empire is fat and lazy, and you just look like you walk in like you belong there, and you spit in their food, and you take what you want, and they're too stupid to know anything has happened.
It actually reminded me a lot of the, going back to the Obi-Wan movie, the TV show, I forget the character who was able to infiltrate, the one who saves Obi-Wan at the place where there's the electric gate.
Indira Varma's character.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I don't remember her name either, but Anyways,
the idea that again of infiltrating.
Which is a thing that's used in Rogue One too, right? Like they sort of blend in. You
that's
know,
true.
I think this is Cassian's sort of skill is like it's not quite, almost a con man, essentially, right? Like, yep. He is a, I'm just going to have the confidence to walk in like I belong there. And they'll never assume it because they're so full of themselves, right? And
but like, there is like an anger there.
Oh yeah, sure.
That is not in a Han Solo, right?
Yes.
He despises these people,
yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yep. And I think that's what we're seeing is it's the people who have really, not just the people who have been sort of affected by the Empire's existence, but the people whom it feels like the Empire has like literally ground their boot heel into, right? Like these are the people that the Empire have stepped on to get where they are, and he is just pissed about it.
And the Stellan Skarsgård character sees that in him and sees like a thing that maybe he can mold or
use
or direct or whatever, and that's interesting, right? I mean, it's a very I do a lot in my head of comparing this to Rebels, in that there are similar themes in Rebels in terms of like we see like here is the Empire actually like strip mining planets and it's bad, and you know we see the proto insurgencies, but Rebels is very different, right? Rebels has a found family and a justice and a like seeing the larger world and trying to do something about it and getting organized, and this is like this is the downtrodden people who are like lashing out, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's actually like who starts the rebellion, right?
Yeah. And I think the message is it starts in a lot of places, right?
Yes. For a lot of different reasons and different causes. And that's.
And I guess Rogue One kind of shows us like some, you know, those are not always completely compatible, right? Even though we all hate the Empire, we can argue about what is justifiable and whose
and
methods
we know,
are too extreme. And,
exactly. We know Saw Gerrera is in this, so I know that is going to have to come up at some point, too. And I think the fact we have Mon Mothma, too, is I envision. Who is probably has a very different philosophy than Saw Gerrera. I think we're actually going to delve into that. What is the right way to fight this rebellion?
I'm always a little amazed that Forrest Whitaker keeps coming back as Gerrera. I just assume like he has such a amazing career that he could do whatever he wants, and
maybe this is what he wants to do. Right?
And maybe this is what he wants to do because I just assume that he doesn't need the money and could be doing all kinds of cool things. And he must. You know, it feels like one of those things where, like, we keep getting you playing that character years over years, and it's like
I gotta imagine it's a pretty cool role, right? You gotta be
he does some things with it, and I don't remember, is it always him when we get like CGI versions of him in Rebels
and
Clone Wars? It's not
Clone
Wars.
It's
not
someone else.
Youngsaw is not him.
He appears briefly too in the Bad Batch, the first episode of Bad Batch.
Is that Forrest Whitaker?
It's the young version.
Does it sound like? Okay, it's a young version.
It's the Clone Wars actor.
The old version is in Rebels. On like a random planet.
Yep.
He does the voice in the Rebels?
And it's Forrest Whitaker, And then he shows up also in Fallen Order, the game.
In Fallen Order for 8 seconds,
Yeah, he's also played by Forrest Whitaker. So, that character has become incredibly influential, I think, in this period, too.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense, right? If you're in Celebratory the Rebellion, to his point, you've got to show the Rebellion being fought different places and all the... we might have a sleep-waking baby.
Or not. We're good.
We're good. We're good.
Okay. I'm amazed we made it this far.
He slept for a long time.
There's a lot going on in that relationship. So I think you're right that we know already as in Rogue One, this is like when we see essentially the end result, the downfall of that approach, right? Like as we see the end of Saw Gerrera, basically. We've seen the beginning of Saw Gerrera. And now we're filling in all these like middle grounds in like Saw's relationship with the rest of the rebels and like where, you know, his viewpoints come and the rest of the rebellion. And the rebellion has not at this point coalesced. And like we've seen that explored a little bit in Rebels as well in terms of like we have these disparate groups who are all kind of fighting, but we don't have a rebel alliance really until we get towards Rogue One.
That is kind of cool. If we think about the name, the Rebel Alliance, like what that actually means is that it's an alliance of various, like, I think factions, again, we're retconning what that name means, but the Rebel Alliance of all these different factions and groups who have different philosophies, and how do you unite them under one banner? It will be interesting to see that play out. And which group this is, and so which faction recruited Cassian? Because we don't know.
Nope.
Similar to the Mandalorian being growing up in the that one sect. We'll see which group of rebels.
Hey, we see Mandalorians take their helmets off all the time. This is not canonical, or maybe that's what this show is all about.
Super excited for season 3.
Yeah, I would say the last thing I was going to say is, 12 episodes seems ambitious. That's bigger than any other Star Wars TV series. So I hope that lands okay.
Well, and I mean, the fact that they've been given a guaranteed second season with 24 episodes, yeah. They've talked a bit about doing time jumps in terms of like going back and forth, and every few episodes they jump a certain amount of time. I think that's going to be interesting and provide a lot of opportunity that we haven't seen in other shows to sort of move around and explore a character from different angles. I agree. 12 episodes seems risky, but yeah, it's sort of 40 minutes an episode. There's a lot you can potentially do there. And really, it feels in some ways like maybe what we're going to get, and Kat and I discussed this, is like 4 3 episode arcs, right? Yeah. Or something like that. And I kind of envisioned that this season might end with Cassian finding his way back to Ferrix and using whatever he is sort of, you know, gleaned from picking up this cause to help sort of liberate or mobilize the people on Ferrix to fight back against this corporation rather than just sort of, you know, passively, sit there as they get cracked down.
I think looking at the credits, the chunking kind of makes sense. These three episodes were directed and written by the same team, Toby Haynes and Tony Gilroy. And then the next three are directed by Susanna White and written by Dan Gilroy. And then it rotates. So it makes sense to me that there might be some chunks to these.
Proper books of Cassian Andor. It actually makes sense, or chapters. I think I'm looking ahead to the next few episodes. I think I'm excited. We know from the trailer, you know, Mon Mothma is going to be this, because sometimes Coruscant. We know he will go back here because we see more Fiona Shaw. I'm excited, and Saw Gerrera's in it. I'm excited to see if he'll see other people of the Rebellion. I wonder if Princess Leia will show up. I'm holding out for that. I'm excited to see the stories we tell, and how these stories will be different than Rebels. And I wonder if Rebels is all the creation of the Alliance is kind of in the background, and it's really focusing on Ezra and the found family. And I think it's actually a story really about more about the Jedi. And Darth, continuing the story of Ahsoka and Darth Vader. This is maybe finally getting the story of how is the Rebellion created? Because I think that's the biggest story that has not been told in Star Wars yet.
And I love this is so far, fingers crossed, the first, I think, first Star Wars canon property, at least on film or TV. I haven't seen a single lightsaber. Yep. I don't think there's even been a mention of the Jedi in these episodes, or the Force, right? Like, none of that gets mentioned, which I think is kind of fascinating, because it is talking about the fact that the Jedi, as we all know, especially in this period, are like a tiny little group of, you know, first of all, there's basically none at this point. Even before, when they were sort of, you know, the peacekeepers, you got the impression like they probably didn't make it out to these planets, right? They were not dealing with like, there's corporations on Ferrix really, you know, like causing problems. We should go out there and settle. No, they didn't care, right? They were in their ivory towers. And like, you know, we've discussed in the previous shows, like the problems with the Jedi Order, and maybe the Jedi aren't always the good guys. But I think this sort of highlights that idea that it's like there's a bunch of regular people who are trying to get by in this world, who are never going to see a Jedi, hear about the Jedi, even think about the Jedi, because it doesn't matter to their situation. And I kind of love, Star Wars is such a big universe, it gives us an opportunity to explore these different nooks and crannies without really having to, you know, have everything have a Skywalker show up.
Yep.
All right, well, there will be much more Andor to come. I'm actually a little sad that it's only one episode a week from here on out. I feel like I kind of want 3 episodes a week, or maybe they should have made the episodes an hour and a half long. I don't know. We will be back to discuss episode 4 of Andor next week. Until then, of course, I would like to thank my co-host, Tony Sindelar. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Goodbye, nerds.
Kat Benish, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. I'm still incredibly sleep deprived, so I have nothing witty to say.
If you'd like to reach out, you can reach us at acp@theincomparable.com or at acp_cast on Twitter. Give us your thoughts, your questions, your comments about Andor, and there's much more Star Wars to come. But we'll continue covering the rest of this show. I am very positive on it. I think everybody on the show kind of is. Everybody on the show is very positive on it. But Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Until then, may the force be with you.